This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Book Podcast. I am Deidre Tyler, host. Today, we'll be talking with Greg Jarrell, author of Our Trespass, White Churches and the Taking of America Neighborhoods. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me on with you.
Thank you. I wonder if you could start by saying a few words about yourself and how you got started with this project.
Sure. So my name is Greg Jarrell. I have lived in Charlotte, North Carolina for about 20 years. I am an ordained minister and a writer and a neighborhood activist who has worked especially on housing issues over the past two decades. And so this book was the fruit of some research that I was doing into my own neighborhood and the story of how my neighborhood. So I'm a white minister, but I've lived in a black neighborhood for the entire time I've lived in Charlotte. And the history of that neighborhood, to understand it, is to understand the impact of urban renewal, the story of white flight, and all this kind of taking place in Charlotte, at least in the 1960s. And so as I sought to sort of uncover some of the story of my neighborhood, it all led back downtown in Charlotte to the federal urban renewal program and to the destruction of the Brooklyn neighborhood here, as it was called, and then four other neighborhoods following that urban renewal project and the displacement of thousands and thousands of households. Almost all black households into other parts of the city, often without any real care or concern or material resources for where people would be moving. And in the center of that old neighborhood now sits a government quarter with the First Baptist Church of Charlotte, the white First Baptist Church, right next door to it. And so it's this really potent symbol of the fusion of theological and political power that kind of created the cityscape, and it still maintains it in that way. So that was the origin of the book, trying to put words to interpret the cityscape in the neighborhood that I live in.
Now, you start the book off with a conversation with Reinhard Wright. Tell us about him and where his house was and what he was saying.
Sure. So Reinhard and I were leading some tours together. We had been introduced by a mutual friend. And as a sort of an amateur at that point, historian, I was leading some neighborhood tours that were kind of doing the same thing without the same level of depth. So helping folks to interpret the development of the city of Charlotte theologically, culturally. And Reinhard had grown up in that Brooklyn neighborhood. And so he would participated with me, or we kind of co-led those tours, I guess is the right way to say it. And so he would walk us through his old neighborhood, right around the grounds of this First Baptist Church, and sort of talk to us about what the neighborhood was like. And so he would describe it in very vivid terms. And among the really captivating things to me is that he would often speak of that Brooklyn neighborhood in the present tense. So for the rest of us, we're trying to imagine what was going on in the past. But for him, it was almost like the landscape was still living around him. Nowadays, the exact spot where his home was covered up in water by a pond in one of our city's most poorly planned and underutilized parks, sitting right next door to First Baptist Church. So his narration of those sidewalks really helped to inform my imagination and my writing. And his memory is part. He died September of 2020, and his memory really kind of spurred me on as well as I was working on the writing.
Now, can the stories of yesterday basically describe something about the city today? What's the importance?
Yeah, I think the stories of yesterday tell us exactly who we are today. It is history that has kind of formed the spaces, the places that we live in. That doesn't necessarily mean that we have to continue to be determined by the mistakes of the past. But the stories of the past certainly describe where we are today. And so to understand any cityscape across the American countryside, to understand any cityscape, we have to understand, where it's been and the social geography of it, not just the shapes of the streets or the shapes of the hills, the flora and fauna that are within it, but the character of the people, the way that money and power have congregated in some places and been kept out of other places, this sort of thing. So the past helps us to understand who we are now, and with some understanding, then it helps us to make some different choices about who we might want to be in the future.
Now, in describing this neighborhood, you talk about the neighborhood being connected with all social classes. Kind of describe to the audience how African-Americans lived in the Jim Crow South.
So, in the Jim Crow South, African-Americans had few choices about where to live. That was one of the realities of segregation. And so in neighborhoods like this Brooklyn neighborhood, you would have found a broad mix of classes. Nowadays, often our neighborhoods may look a little bit different. They may be more sorted by class as well as by race. But in this day, you could have found very well-to-do people inside the Brooklyn neighborhood living on the same block even as very poor people. So prominent folks inside the Brooklyn area included a government diplomat, a pharmacist, some well-to-do attorneys, ministers who were, of rather high stature, relatively wealthy business owners, and living next door to or on the same block as laborers, porters, working class people, folks struggling to hang on to jobs. And so within that mix of social classes, I think there was kind of a solidarity that was built in because of the limited options and opportunities that the Jim Crow South created.
Absolutely. And lots of role models for students and people.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the gifts of kind of multi-class communities, is that people are able to really pay attention to, learn from one another, to offer mentorships, that sort of thing. Those kinds of options, I think, are very much missed in our current arrangements.
Absolutely. Now, tell us about the 1949 policies and how that created slum areas and how that impacted African-Americans.
Yeah, so the Housing Act of 1949 was signed by President Truman, and in the preamble to that act, he said that among its goals was to provide for every American family a safe and decent home as soon as practicable. the goal there was, or what had been observed was that in the aftermath of the Gilded Age of the 1920s and then the Depression, that poor people's housing, especially in cities around the country, was in rough shape. And as money was kind of fleeing the cities, as well-to-do people were often moving out to the suburbs, then you had all these exploitative landlords that were now living at a distance. And so there were legitimately bad conditions in a lot of American cities. The Housing Act of 1949 created the Urban Renewal Administration, it was called then. And the task that the Urban Renewal Administration was given was called in the act slum clearance. And so the immediate kind of effect of that was to call some neighborhoods slums. And what this act did was to make money available for cities to clear those slums. That is just to raise them, to tear them down. And so in a society beset by white supremacy, then certainly black neighborhoods were the easiest targets with the least political power to fight back, that were called slums. And that this happened, by the time the Urban Renewal Agency, as it came to be called, ceased in 1974, more than 1,200 municipalities around the country had used those federal funds for an urban renewal project. Large portions of those were black neighborhoods in cities and in small towns all around the country. And so they were kind of the first targets. Of course, if you lived in a neighborhood like Brooklyn, you didn't call your own neighborhood a slum. And in many, many cases, those neighborhoods did not have slum conditions, or they did not have only slum conditions. And part of the weakness of that federal legislation was that simply tearing down a neighborhood was not going to eliminate slum conditions. It was more likely simply to move housing exploitation to another location.
Now, you tell the story from former slaves, Sarah North and her husband, Abram North. Tell us about them. You gave us so much rich history about that couple.
Yeah, so Abram and Annie North were both born enslaved. Abram in Walterboro, South Carolina, which is just inland from Charleston, kind of a rice-growing area. Annie was born, Annie Carson, in downtown Charlotte. And so I tracked their families both back as far as I could and forward to their descendants now. Abram and Annie turned out to be relatively important religious and political figures in the late 1800s in Charlotte. Annie was among the founders of the oldest black church in Mecklenburg County, which is called Clinton Chapel AME Zion Church, a church that grew out of the Hush Arbors, which are an important but often kind of unknown chapter of the story of enslavement and the struggle for freedom inside black communities dealing with those conditions. Abram was, among other things, one of the organizers here in Charlotte of North Carolina's Fusion Movement. That was a political movement in the late 1800s that combined the fused together the interests of poor white people and black people all across the state. And in that really key political moment, those folks took over the state government. They rewrote all manner of legislation. They really offered a deeply hopeful, multiracial, democratic movement for this state that ultimately was broken up by a white supremacist reaction to that. Abram and Annie seemed to be kind of the life of the neighborhood in some ways. They were known for throwing good parties, for loving to entertain. A woman that I interviewed actually had vivid memories of going to tea parties at Annie's house when she was a child. So that's how relatively recent this history is, that I talked to somebody who has vivid memories of a woman who was born into slavery.
And you talk about Samuel Smith. How does he fit into this story?
Yeah, so Sam Smith was also born on a plantation, like Abram North was, but Sam was the heir to the plantation rather than it being held by it. Sam was a member of a prominent Mecklenburg County family, became really a very high achiever as an attorney and as a banker, and was one of the most prominent members of the First Baptist Church of Charlotte, the White First Baptist Church. So by chance, immediately following the Civil War, one of the relatively few jobs available to Black families, Black people, was as a domestic servant, a maid or a butler. And so Abram North lived in the home of Samuel Smith, right next door to First Baptist Church for at least several years. It's kind of hard to determine exactly how many. And so Sam Smith was really influential in the development of First Baptist Church and sort of the entanglement of the North family and that institution really begins there in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War and will go on for a full century, which is kind of what makes the book work. That's the central conflict that I'm turning around.
Tell us about the political climate during that time of the North's family life.
Yeah, so I think you could think of the contradictions of that political moment. On the one hand, the Reconstruction era from 1867 to 1876 really was a really hopeful moment where it seemed like the United States might have the will to put together a functioning multiracial democracy. And so there's lots of excitement. There's new employment opportunities. There are African-Americans moving to cities all over the South out of plantation environments, out of the former enslavement conditions that they were in. So there's new opportunity available. There are churches that are springing up, businesses, all sorts of institutions to meet the needs of those Black people so that they can really grow the culture that they had dreamed of. At the same time, around the South, you have the white elites who are fighting to get their power and their prestige and their economy back. And so to live in that era was to live inside those contradictions. On the one hand, to be pushing for this multiracial democracy, and on the other hand, to be haunted by the specter of this thing that wasn't going to die and that the white elite were not willing to let go of and wanted to reinvent in some way.
You talk about the life of the Norse being very self-contained. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so inside the Brooklyn neighborhood, the neighborhood was, it sort of had to be self-contained because the conditions of segregation were such that you had to do it yourself. You didn't have equal opportunity on the outside of the neighborhood. So again, this is a sort of a set of contradictions. On the one hand, you have Black residents inside the Brooklyn neighborhood who, as former residents there have described to me, you could be born there, you could go to school there, you could get your first job, you would go to church where the preacher would marry you, you could start a family, you could have babies, you could build a career, all the way until you died, and then you could have your body prepared for burial, and all that could happen inside the Brooklyn neighborhood, inside just a few blocks. Part of the reason that neighborhoods like that had to be kind of self-contained was because you weren't equal. You didn't have opportunity on the outside of the neighborhood. And so it was a siege. The conditions were like a military siege where resources weren't allowed to flow in. They regularly flowed out, but it was hard to get money on the inside. And so yet it was necessary to invent all of these systems on your own because you didn't have any of the rest of the support that white society provided.
I thought it was interesting that Mr. North was still working at his death. What was he doing during that time, and what did the newspaper say about him?
Yeah, so he was he worked a variety of jobs over the course of his life. When he died, he was the elevator operator at the Belk department store, sort of the flagship store of the Belk department store chain that's still active today, was right in downtown Charlotte. So when Abram died, he was the elevator operator there, but he had worked as a church janitor for a number of years. He had worked as an insurance agent. He had held a variety of jobs. And when he passed, he was well remembered in the newspaper. The language of the white newspapers, of course, was patronizing and somewhat belittling. They talked about him as the language would be something like one of the good Negroes. And at the same time, he was beloved inside his own community as well. And so it was a man who had really kind of developed a gravitas, maybe, is kind of how it comes through in the archives about himself, as a religious, as a political, as a cultural leader in the city of Charlotte. He also was, had a long habit of writing letters to the editors of the various newspapers, the religious newspapers and the various Charlotte newspapers. And so part of the reason I was able to dig up so much of his story was because he kind of left this trail behind, with all these kind of hints that showed up in the editorial letters that were published.
Now, tell us about how you talked about this brochure in the 1940s, and it was talking about the dangers of selling to blacks. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the National Association of Real Estate Brokers, I believe it was called, NAREB, was the sort of the governing body of the real estate industry, of realtors. And so among their standards, one of kind of the chief standards was that you are obligated as a realtor never to sell or never to compromise the value of a person's or a client's real estate. And one of the overt examples that were given in that is that you would not introduce into a potential client into a neighborhood if you thought that they were of bad character in some way. And the examples that NAREB listed in this kind of ethical guidelines for realtors included various criminal sorts of behaviors, but it also included a black family. I think it mentions like a black father who thinks he might be moving up in the world or this kind of thing. And so there's this real sense that that segregation was not only enforced by legal means, but it was also enforced by business interests, including by the ethical standards of the real estate industry. So, that was as American cities developed through the 1940s, it was not just law that made segregation happen. It was a whole broad set of practices from multiple different industries.
Now, you talk about one artifact that was found from the North's home or possession in which they gave someone. Tell us about that picture.
Yeah, so there's one artifact from the Old North home that I have been able to locate, and it may be the only one left. It is a black and white print of Jean-Francois Millet's painting, The Gleaners. This is from about 1857, I believe is the year, in France. Historians call that period Second Empire France, a moment sort of like the Gilded Age, the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties in the United States, of great wealth inequality. And what Millet's painting does is it contains at the foreground the renderings of three gleaners, thus the name the gleaners. And behind them is a whole city of folks who have built up these large, enormous mounds of golden straw. There's a man on horseback who looks like an overseer. And then there are these three women who are the subject of the painting, and they're gleaning and they're tired and they're bent over. And you can sort of see the vast difference that has been built into this system of poverty, and this economic system that has created their poverty. And so it turns out that not only do the Norths have a copy of this picture, probably prominently displayed in their home, but it appears that many African-Americans did around the country, certainly around the South. Among the most prominent of those was the childhood home of Martin Luther King Jr., where there's still a copy of this painting in that home as it's been preserved in Atlanta. So it's, though the subject matter is immediately 1850s France, it's something that African-Americans seem to be able to see themselves in, and that really stands as a remarkable kind of testament to that, to the social makeup of that period. And so the North passed it on to their church, and it's still in the archive room there.
Now, you went from the 1950s, 60s, 70s to tell the story about urban development. Can you give us some of the highlights as to how this story started in the 50s and it ended in the 70s?
Yeah, so the urban renewal program of the federal government promised cities that when they were embarking on these so-called slum clearance projects, that they would, the feds would pay two-thirds of the cost of buying out an area, raising all the properties in it, and then cities had the opportunity to either build public works buildings, public infrastructure like highways, or if they wanted, then to auction some of the land off. So federal funds are paying for the largest portion of these projects, but they're administered, they're selected, and they're managed by cities themselves. And so all the host of presuppositions, especially around race, are going to come into play into which neighborhoods get cleared. So these projects over the course of the 25-year period from 1949 to 1974, when the Urban Renewal Administration was active, took place in more than 1,200 cities, from our largest cities, New York, Los Angeles, Houston, Chicago, to very small towns in North Carolina. One's as small as Laurinburg, North Carolina, which has a population of probably 10 to 15,000. So those projects cleared areas in the Brooklyn neighborhood that I've written extensively about. 240 acres were cleared, just razed down to the ground. The rule in North Carolina was if you could prove that 67%, two-thirds, of the neighborhood was derelict or decrepit or blighted beyond repair, then you could take 100% of the neighborhood. So you didn't have to spare anything. And when they did the inspections here to sort of make the case that it was two-thirds blighted, they actually didn't even walk inside any buildings. They just kind of walked up and down the sidewalks and made notes along the way. So all kinds of injustices were built into this program.
Now, you had incident of the Friendship Baptist Church and Mr. Vernon Sawyer. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that message he gave to the congregation on that Sunday day.
Yeah, so the part of my arguments within this book is that urban renewal was it was not just a political program, but it was a theological one as well, that it sort of betrays a theological set of assumptions and messages. And one of the places that gets really clear is when Vernon Sawyer, who was the executive director of Charlotte's Redevelopment Commission, so he's the boss of urban renewal in Charlotte, he shows up at Friendship Baptist, perhaps the most prominent black church in Charlotte then, as it is today. And he didn't know, they didn't know that he was coming on this morning. It's November 1970 or 1960 rather. And he asks for a place in the pulpit, and he tells the congregation, "The hour is getting late," were his words, "for you to determine where you'll be moving your church." But they didn't know prior to that morning that they would be moving their church. In fact, preachers in particular, but other civic leaders, had been arguing against urban renewal, in part because they said, "Who will attend our churches? Who will patronize our businesses if you tear down all the houses around us?" What had been cleared, what had been communicated, rather, by men like Vernon Sawyer and by the city staff and public elected officials, was that homes would be taken out, but not churches, not businesses, not the schools, not everything. So they said, you know, "Who will attend our institutions if you take, if you remove all the people?" So Friendship found out that they were taking the institutions as well during their worship service in mid-November 1960. And to sort of further the theological point, after he told them that they were coming to take the building, Sawyer said to the congregation there that something like, "I want you to consider that in the vast expanse of time," that those were his words, "it is you who have been chosen to lead our city at this crucial hour." So I really grasped onto that language of chosenness. That's theological language of being a chosen people. But what he's doing really is inverting that language to mean something other than what we might normally think about. They've been chosen for this kind of suffering, and he's casting it as leadership, even though the entire project is unnecessary, as it turns out. So that's the scene from Friendship in 1960.
Now, after that message, the church met together. What did they discuss?
So, yeah, they had a meeting that evening. I guess they called like an emergency meeting. And the pastor from the records there seems to have tried to encourage them, "Hey, we've got to find a way to move forward." Of course, that was, the unfortunate standard within black communities all around the country, because they simply had no options. They didn't have the power to change those the conditions. They didn't have the power to stop the bulldozers or to end the program. And so they had to very quickly decide, you know, "We'll find ways to grieve over this space, over this neighborhood, over our beloved building and our sanctuary. But we've got to find a way to put one foot in front of the other and move forward, because we can't do anything about it."
Now, in chapter 7, you talk about the white church debate. There was lots of, you know, restaurants being integrated, but they wanted the church to remain white. And what was this debate going on about?
Yeah, so the white churches all around the country and white businesses were having to make a key decision. White flight is happening within cities. The suburbs are growing. All the policies that are being written as far as zoning and transportation policy, mortgage policies, tax policies are steering people towards the suburbs. And so we call this period white flight. And so white flight is happening, which means that these downtown churches on Main Street, in Charlotte, our main street is called Tryon Street. Their folks are moving 15, 20, 25 minutes away by car from their institution. And so the institution has this existential moment. Do we exist to remain downtown, sort of in the center, symbolically and geographically, of power within our cities? Or do we need to move out where our people are? At First Baptist Church of Charlotte, they nearly split the church in this debate. These were hotly contested decisions all over the country. At First Baptist, they nearly split the church, trying to figure out whether they were going to move to a 16-acre lot about 20 minutes to the south of downtown, maybe 15 minutes to the south of downtown, or whether they were going to stay downtown. They ultimately, after nearly splitting the church a year or so later, they came around to the decision that they would move, but within downtown Charlotte. They would build a suburban campus, which is to say one with plenty of parking, but they would do it in the former Brooklyn neighborhood that was in the midst of being torn down.
Now, who was Raymond E. King? Tell us about that picture.
There's a photograph that's well known in Charlotte, and it's on the cover of the book, as your audience has a chance to see it. Ray King was a white liberal. He was a progressive leader. He was a Democrat. You would have called him in the 1960s one of Charlotte's white civil rights leaders. He was of enough importance locally and in the state of North Carolina that when the Kennedy administration began discussions in 1963 for what would eventually become the 1964 Civil Rights Act passed by President Johnson after Kennedy's death, Ray King was invited to the White House for those discussions. So we're talking about a man of political heft. But there's this photo that has become relatively well documented in Charlotte and seen of Ray King riding on a bulldozer while he's wearing a suit in sort of the ceremonial first destruction during an urban renewal project following the Brooklyn neighborhood in a Charlotte neighborhood called Greenville. And this was in 1970. So the key contradiction of that picture to me was really part of what spurred this research along, that, you know, a good white progressive who had put his reputation and his kind of work on the line to write op-eds, to agitate for this civil rights movement, would then be seen and forever memorialized in this photograph, you know, driving a bulldozer, wearing a suit in the destruction of yet another black neighborhood through these urban renewal projects.
Now, many families had to relocate, and they decided to give loan money. Tell us about this loan money that the families could receive.
So families had to relocate. They didn't have a choice because the government was going to tear their houses down. And so there were small numbers of resources that were available. If you were a homeowner in the Brooklyn neighborhood, about somewhere between 7 and 10% of residents were homeowners. Then you would get bought out. You were inevitably, black homeowners were bought out for less than white homeowners were, sometimes in multiples of 2 or 3 less than the white landowners were bought out. If you're a renter, then you basically got nothing. There was a staff person of the Redevelopment Commission who might try to push you towards a potential housing option. But for the most part, there was little recompense at all. There was very little money that flowed. And in fact, the city, for several years at the beginning of these urban renewal projects, the city of Charlotte refused to build any public housing. They simply said the market will take care of this problem. The market had created the problem of housing exploitation. It was not going to solve it, but that was sort of the naive belief that city leadership here had.
Now, you had a chance to talk with some of the Norse descendants. What did you find in those conversations?
Oh, they're brilliant, delightful people. Brandy and Tiffany and Regina North spent a lot of time with me, and I've been so grateful for that. We had some really fascinating discussions. They were quite open about their ongoing kind of material economic struggles. They don't have that much money. And that's the result of, in part, the result of the transfer of wealth from their ancestors who owned land that is now extremely valuable. But that land was forcibly taken from them with very little recompense. And they were forced to move to a neighborhood that that then became devalued over the course of the next 50 years. And so even that small investment they have did not accumulate wealth in the way that the land that they owned downtown, which was taken over by First Baptist Church of Charlotte, the way that that land has appreciated. So they have lacked the opportunity to accumulate wealth in the same way that white institutions and families have. Nevertheless, they're people of strong faith. Brandy, in particular, is an activist who has done really brilliant work with several different organizations, both locally and nationally. They're just delightful people, and they had some really sharp and prescient words to offer towards to me and to my audience within this book.
Can you tell us the overall message you want the reader to leave with once they finish your book?
Sure. I think there are a couple of things that I want folks to leave with. For one, I want folks to recognize that the combination of bad theology and bad policy creates really bad results for our cities. Urban renewal was both bad theology and bad policy, and we still live with the scars of urban renewal all over our cities. You see that most clearly in urban highways that just create these kind of zones, these dead zones, and that were built just through this widespread destruction of all the land that it took to take over and to build highways through our densely settled American cities. So that's one thing that I want folks to know. I want people to consider that we can and we should collectively as a society and as institutions, we can and we should make reparations. We should make repairs. And so I cast that in theological language. What Regina North told me in one word was that people should repent, which is to say, start moving in a different direction, start building a different kind of city, one that is fully economically and politically inclusive, so that everybody has the opportunity that they need to thrive. And so, I want folks to really consider the ways that advantage has accumulated and our responsibility, especially within white churches and communities, to risk that advantage for the sake of justice. I also want folks to consider the cultural importance of our institutions and what they've passed on to us. So there's a key moment for me in my research. I didn't write about it quite this way. But there's a key moment at First Baptist Church as they're discussing their move, and they've built a consensus. We're going to move to this neighborhood that's been destroyed, and we're not going to talk about it at all. We're going to pretend that nothing has happened. And they sing a hymn that is a conquest hymn. The name of the hymn in European hymnals is called "Lead On, O King Eternal." It says, "Henceforth in fields of conquest, your tents will be our home." And when I discovered that hymn, when I sort of found that in the business meeting notes, among the remarkable things to me was that I know that hymn. I grew up with it. I'm 44 years old, but I could still sing it back to you, having grown up with that. And so we still swim in the water of this kind of ethic, ethos of conquest, of patronizingly and oppressively taking over people's spaces and thinking that we're doing the right thing. So coupled with that material importance is that we have to work on the culture inside our institutions so that we don't make these kinds of mistakes anymore.
Well, I've taken up enough of your time. Can you tell the audience, what is your next project you're working on?
I'm not sure yet. I want to take this work and continue to expand it. I think that I've written intensely about Charlotte, though there are examples of it within this book of the way that this exact same kind of process happened in other cities. I think there's space for kind of a national, maybe a broader survey. So maybe there's some work to do with that. I'm also working now with a group called the Redress Movement that is aiming to help repair some of the mistakes of the past. And so I think the next project for me is probably to stick with this book and this work and continue to work on it in hopes of building kind of a movement around repairing some of the damage that we've done within American cities and creating a more hopeful future for us all.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate the invitation.